that we just bring into Parliament and we just did the necessary. And today we are debating domestic violence and we so much want to listen to it. But according to the order paper, it will be around about 3 o'clock up on stream. And I hope by that time completed. But if we are not completed, then a few of us will still remain behind. The next organization that will have to give us the input now will be GAP. And you can start, ma'am. I'm just looking for my program.
Thank
you, may I start? And just give your name, please.
Okay. I'm Miranda Simri. I represent the Gender Advocacy Program, or GAP, which is based in Cape Town. In anticipation of these hearings, GAP works with a number of other civil society organizations and in partnership with the Western Cape Network on Violence Against Women, organized to facilitate a process whereby these organizations are all working in the domestic violence arena, would get together to work on submitting a joint proposal to this committee, a joint submission to this committee. We agreed that some of those organizations, you have them later on the program, will cover some of the areas that we submitted our submission on, and that GAP would speak to one area, which is the victim empowerment program. Just in terms of the background to where the victim empowerment program comes from, it's one of the key programs of the National Crime Prevention Strategy and is one of 9 programs of Pillar 1, which specifically focuses on making the criminal justice system more effective and efficient. The VP is an intersectoral, interdepartmental program that seeks to promote a victim-centered approach to crime prevention. It seeks to develop services and programs for victims of crime and violence to minimize the effects of crime on victims and has a targeted focus on women and children. The victim empowerment is based on the principle that victims are to be empowered in terms of taking responsibility and ownership for part of the process to get them to addressing the effects of violence on themselves. The components of the VEP are the following. There's training with justice and trust officials to foster greater victim sensitivity, a victim support program based on research that was previously done, and provision of basic information to victims regarding the progress of their cases, as well as information on helping them to prepare and to lay complaints more effectively and more easily. The Department of Social Development is the lead implementing organization for the VEP, but as with other government initiatives, works in collaboration with departments of justice, health, and so on. There are 4 pieces of policy that provide the framework for the VEP. The first is the Service Charter for Victims of Crime, which outlines 7 rights to victims. Those rights are the right to be treated with fairness and respect for the individual's dignity and privacy, the right to offer information, the right to receive information, the right to protection, the right to assistance, be that legal, social, health, and counseling, the right to compensation when a victim has suffered loss or damage to their property, and the right to restitution where a victim of crime has been unlawfully dispossessed of their goods or their properties been damaged in the process. The second piece of policy is the minimum standards for service delivery and victim empowerment, which defines service standards and makes special provisions for victims of domestic violence in terms of the provision of shelters and safety and security, as well as health care and access to education for children. The numbering went all wrong, but the third piece is the Uniform Protocol on Victim Empowerment, which seeks specifically to address the needs of victims of sexual offences and domestic violence. And the last is the Integrated Victim Empowerment Policy, which provides guidelines in terms of the establishment, development, and delivery of victim empowerment services. we thought that what would be useful is you have the whole submission in your pack, that we just use these few minutes to highlight some of the problems with the victim empowerment program. On the whole, one of the major issues is that women don't know their rights in terms of the access to services that domestic violence complainants are entitled to. Now, previous speakers have alluded to and emphasized this issue, and it's something that we again wish to emphasize here. The component of the VEP that deals with training justice and sex officials to introduce greater victim sensitivity is ineffectual, and again, this has been noted before, and we are emphasizing this again. The component of the VEP that deals with the provision of basic information to complainants regarding the status and progress of their cases is also not functioning as it should. The seven rights of the victims outlined in the service charter, which I mentioned first, those rights are not being realized. With regard to the right to be treated with fairness and respect for dignity and privacy, complainants often do not have this. Other speakers have spoken to the fact that confidentiality is not maintained, that people's dignity are not being respected, and again, that's an issue that we wish to point out. With regard to the right to offer information, many women are denied this right because they are not allowed the opportunity to participate in criminal justice proceedings. With regard to the right to receive information, this right, again, is not being allowed as often, and it's something that came about strongly yesterday when we had the issue of people having the right to be given information and to give information in their language of choice. And again, and specifically with related to rural communities, this is a right that service providers strongly wish to emphasize and find that there are major problems with. With regard to the right to protection, which entails being free from intimidation and harassment, inadequate resource allocation restricts this right and really brings the Domestic Violence Act into ill repute, given that at the moment it's more a piece of paper and is not being implemented to the extent that we wish to see it. The right to assistance, such as access to social health, counseling, and legal services. There's much research that documents evidence to the extent to which this right is being violated. And again, some of that would have been highlighted this morning in Mosaic's presentation and will again come to your attention in presentations that follow this one. With regard to the right of victims of violent crime to compensation, many women are still unable to access this compensation for loss of or damage to their property. Again, one of the speakers yesterday, a woman who lives on a farm, was speaking to the fact that her property gets damaged and there's no recourse for when that happens. And again, this is something that we wish to highlight. The right to restitution, that many women have been denied restitution where they've been unlawfully dispossessed of their property or where their goods and property have been damaged. While the minimum standards define acceptable service levels and standards, government service delivery appears to be largely oblivious to these stipulations in that the service delivery is not up to the standard that government itself has set for itself. And so we wish to point out that this needs to be attended to. Secondary victimization, as mentioned by previous speakers yesterday, is not defined in the victim's charter, nor in the minimum standards. The Uniform Protocol on Victim Empowerment and the Integrated Victim Empowerment Policy lacks monitoring, and the VEP currently does not have a monitoring and evaluation strategy which is linked to it. There's a need for victim empowerment legislation, and while these policy frameworks are helpful, they are not legislated, and so there's a need to attend to victim empowerment legislation specifically, as well as the need to reassess the grant-making process. And some of the organizations will highlight this again, where specifically shelters are unable to apply for grants as they are not considered to be a direct service. On to our recommendations, and again, you'd have full recommendations in the document, but briefly, what we need to highlight is the following. The assessment of policy provisions and addressing the impediments to implementation of these provisions is important. There's a need for greater intersectoral collaboration to maximize the impact of the victim empowerment program. that adequate resource allocation and gender-sensitive budgeting needs to be given priority, that there is an assessment and improvement of service delivery by SAPS and the Department of Justice. But in the same vein, we'd like to stress the fact that other departments are important in terms of the implementation of the DBA, and that hence assessment and improvement of these service delivery, for example, health and education, that needs to be taken into account as well. And again, that victim empowerment legislation needs to be implemented. Creating a victim-friendly legal system, which includes support for legal professionals in integrating victim support and victim empowerment into the legal service. There's a need for appropriate, adequate healthcare, and again, healthcare which is sensitive to the needs of victims of domestic violence, and particularly to women who suffer abuse and domestic violence. Then meeting the basic needs of victims to avoid secondary victimization. We've noted this before, and other organizations have pointed it out. The need to recognize the needs of secondary victims, and this is something that Professor Van Ass spoke to yesterday, and we'd like to support and to re-emphasize that is a priority area to be addressed. And then to reassess the funding criteria for grants, so that civil society organizations, and I applaud the chair who earlier spoke to the need to assist civil society organizations who are ultimately doing the work in this area, and that we really look at the process for grant making to civil society organizations. And that's
I'd like to thank you for this input, because there's quite a lot that we are learning, because there are things that are being repeated, but it's good when things are being emphasized, because it will make us alert when it comes to whatever the report actually that we will be drawing up. And as it is to, I think earlier today, the WIP of the committee spoke to, the privacy, because it did come up in our meetings, and even the protection order too, because you are right, it's a paper. And I always say, women die with that paper in their hands, and that is the truth. Because imagine, like, there was a case in Peewee at some point, where someone called me and the woman was deaf and dumb, and her husband was beating her up. So she ran out the house. She couldn't scream. And what happened? She ran into someone else's house. And then he ran in the house and he stabbed her, which meant he endangered that family too. And, you know, such things we are wary about. Are there any questions to the presenter? Yes, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chair. It's not a question. Actually, let me thank the presenter once more for the presentation. As you indicated that, you know, most of the issues that she raised were also covered in the previous, you know, presentation. It is just for us to make sure that really at the end of this, we tighten and improve our act, because our act is there, but as the chair said earlier, that perhaps there are certain sectors which are still missing in the act. So I think that this process will actually assist us, you know, in ensuring that we make it the act effective.
Thanks for that, Honourable Member. Anyone else that would like to speak? From the legislation. I think that will be the only question, and we have to thank you, because this will empower us as a committee, you know, and just add it to the other that was said to us today. Thank you. Thank you. Sarki Bartman for Women and Children. Thank you, ma'am.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Shaiman McLeod, and I'm representing the Sarki Bartman Center for Women and Children. Our center offers a range of services to women and children who have experienced domestic and sexual violence. We are a one-stop center managing 8 projects, including 2 shelters strategically placed in the Amandenberg and Worcester region, areas that are riddled with crime, gangsterism, unemployment, and drug and alcohol abuse. The center, through our partnership of 9 NGOs based on our premises, assists approximately 550 to 600 clients per month. Having been in existence for 10 years, we feel we can speak with authority on the implementation or lack of implementation of the Domestic Violence Act, because over the last year we have seen a marked increase of 114% of clients that access services at our center. At the Sarki Bartman Center and shelter, we see the most horrific forms of abuse to both women and children, and can say with absolute conviction that the Domestic Violence Act does not protect the majority of the survivors of abuse. Over the years, we have had to work very hard to provide the services that women need, services that we believe we should be getting greater assistance from the government division. And shelters, for example, receive an average of 200 to 300 rand a month, where they are expected to provide basic services as well as counseling, legal advice and assistance, life skills and job skills programs, and a host of other services. We would just like to pose the question here today as to where the funding is to provide the accommodation, the food, the medical services, the counseling and legal care that these survivors so desperately need. Where do the survivors go, and what resources are they able to access once they leave the shelters? The policies for special needs housing has been in draft form for the past 9 years. And there is still a definite need for economic empowerment programs to assist those survivors who have chosen to break the cycle of abuse and rebuild their lives. We believe there is a lack of support services such as the mental health services, the legal services, and unfortunately the South African police services are not able to or are providing adequate services for both the women and children. We believe the relevant officials are not adequately trained to offer effective services in a sensitive manner. And having said that, we certainly commend government for bringing about, you know, the best legislation that there is in South Africa, but unfortunately there is a lack of accountability, monitoring and evaluation. With that, I would like to hand over to my colleague Rose, who will give you a case study of one of the situations that we see on a daily basis within our shelters.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the opportunity that is granted to us as women today. I came to work this morning and still feeling very angry to a case that came through to us last night. A lady coming from the rural areas to come and have a look for what she can achieve and how she can best support her family financially. Got involved with a young man, and there's a baby between the two of them. She went to visit a friend sometime in June, July, And as she came back from the visit of a friend, she found that the boyfriend whom she's living with was not at home. She then decided to go back because it's getting late, and she decided to go back to a friend's house. And as it became later, she decided to stay over till the next morning. And as she came back with the baby, she found that a boyfriend was back home, and he started to fight with her, verbally abusing her. And it went on for the whole day. The night, she was exhausted and decided she was going to bed with the baby. And he just sat in the kitchen, and she thought he put water on, just maybe he's going to make a cup of coffee for them, so things will, the matter will be settled. But what happened was, while she was fast asleep with the baby, the water that he boiled, he poured over her. This woman came to us last night. I think it should be more or less, we talk about third degree burns, which is severe, but I think this, it looked for me like fifth degree burns. The way, she must have been a very pretty woman. She was so burned that they had to make at the hospital a hole in her throat, and they put a machine in so that she could speak. As I passed her this morning, I could just hear the sound of that, how she breathed and how she struggled to breathe. And she's so burned and she's so banished up still. She needs to go to the hospital for dressing every day. And while I was looking at her this morning, and I thought, you look so beautiful. And you know, a face is so burned, a head is so burned, that it's like little holes that's in her head, and then big patches that, I think that's how she burned. And I couldn't speak to her yet because she was on her way to the hospital, but as a woman, it made me angry. It made me angry in a way that, how come he didn't just do that and run away, and he's still at large, he's still out somewhere. And the amazing part is that a lot of these abuses happen to women in our society, that the same man will go and have another woman, and they keep on abusing and abusing and abusing. I felt so heartbroken this morning to think that this woman, because of the safety of herself and the baby, she didn't want to go back, or she was the home. But because of this jealousy, he accused of having an affair with somebody else, even though he didn't even want to reason with her. He didn't want to understand that she slept with a friend at a friend's place, which is an elderly woman. And so this morning I thought, and I sit and I thought to myself, we talked about freedom. Are we really free as women? We fought so hard for our country to change. We fought so hard as women for apartheid to be demolished, but yet we are still in our own prisons and get abused in our own prisons. We talked about children. We talked about our children who's going to be the future of our country. And then I feel that what is there, what role modeling is there for our children? What future is there for our children in our country if we say that they are going to be our future? And I was saying to myself, and I thought, is there anybody in this house that can tell me today how many more of our women needs to be killed, raped, or abused? Is there a number, specific number, and say, if there's 5 killed, they will give answers to that? How about, are we going to do it? I'm coming back to the different police stations. We've done some work with the different police stations. There is good policemen. There is good police stations as well. The implementation, the act is good, but the implementation of it is something that we need to look at. I can talk about a lot of cases, but I just want to highlight the one. I can talk about a case where a woman, by the policeman, was asked to carry a television. She was pregnant, 6 months pregnant, and he said, but I can't carry the TV for you. You must carry it yourself because I got a back problem. That is a problem for me within the system, that why isn't there people that can go back to those people, even though you talk and talk about things, you go. I'm also part of the police forum, and there's the good things that happen there, but there's also things like this lady who was burned. How far are we going to take this? You see children coming in to the centers that have been raped by their own fathers, sleeping in the middle of mom and dad, and the child got raped. And the mom was told that you can't satisfy me.
What, how the child can satisfy me. Those things are things that really is bothering women. It's bothering us. And I was thinking of, I'm a mother of five, I've got children. But I try to teach my children, my sons, to be better citizens. We've got our creche at the center where we don't take any weaponry toys in our creche. We destroy it. We don't even give it to other children. We destroy it. Because we want to eradicate violence against women and children. And so the small things that we try to do within our community, we want to come and say to the higher authority, which is government, that joining hands together, we can make a difference. And just being here today, just sitting here and watching, or just being aware that there's an ear listening today to the plight of women and children, I really want to salute the women of South Africa that is really making a difference in the world, a difference in the life of women and children. I thank you.
Thanks a lot, Raoul, for that moving input. I still have a few shivers that's going up my back. And these are things we do see. And we'd like to help our women to rectify, you know, what is taking place. And I think therefore, yeah, this hearing, because we know there are shortcomings within the act itself. And government do have challenges. And we'd like to see, you know, how could we rectify that. Thank you. Are there any people that would like to speak, even comment to? Thank you. Raoul, just put off your... Yes,
Chairperson, we are sorry to be listening to these pathetic things that are raised in various presentations to this committee. And our view is that together we can do more. Now, the point is raised of victims of violence and problem in respect to implementation. I just want to put one question that in your view as the center, what do you think is the problem with the implementation? Is it a problem of institutional arrangement? Is it a problem of the act? Is it a problem of fear? And what would you suggest could be done as a way to improve that? And this question, I think, has been coming again and again and again. I'm asking this question deliberately to you because at the center you say you are helping 550 to 60 people a day. And the second question I want to ask you, the question relating to freedom versus marriage, that we fought very hard to get freedom in the country, and in marriage there's a lot of violence that really leaves the women not free. What do you think needs to be tightened up there in order to create the opposite in the marriage field, because what we think that institution needs to be an institution of happiness, because it's an institution that must produce people and leaders of tomorrow. What do you think could be done to make that institution to be an institution of happiness?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the sad presentation. Very, very sad. You know, Chair, when I look at the name of this the project, it's Sarki Bartman, a woman who went through suffering. And here we are, instead of things improving. It's like they're getting worse. I'm not sure what has happened to this society. The society in which we live today. For a human being to take boiling water, what is in his mind whilst he's doing that? Is there really nothing that speaks to him to say, no, no, don't do it? To a helpless someone, because, I mean, even if that woman was awake, he was still going to pour that water, the boiling water onto her shoe. He was still going to burn it because he's got physical, you know, power to do that over someone who is helpless. That is why I'm saying I don't know what has happened to this society. And again, if I reiterate the words by the acting chair there to say, together we can do more, because government alone cannot do it. Yes, we do agree that there's lack of funding, but I think we should not despair, because somewhere we will be able to achieve our goal, even if we are not able to do that, you know, wholly. I mean, we cannot do that. Like I said earlier, you can't eradicate that. But I think together we can still do it. Yes, government cannot do it alone. Society cannot do it alone. I don't know what to say. I really don't want to say it's that's cruelty, barbarism for a human being to do that.
Thank you very much for the presentation and also the very horrific incident that your organization had to deal with, and as I hear, you also have many others. I just want to make a comment, and while I was at the provincial legislature in the Western Cape for the past 5 years, on Freedom Days, I always used to say that although we are politically free, we are far from being free, economically as well as socially, especially for women, for children, for persons with disabilities, for our youth. And then also I wish to include, because we are now free for more than, what is it now, 15, sorry, all of a sudden my math's gone. For enough years to be able to say, even for men as well, because roles have changed over the decades. And I always go back and say, when we look at family, you know, and again I'm challenging the NGOs with regard to your programs, because like my colleague said, we all have to work together. But I challenge the NGOs to go and look at your own program, because a lot of things have changed. For instance, our families, it is not a nuclear family that we have, like the mother and the father and the kids. We have child-headed households. We have single-parent households. We have elderly people looking after kids. We have orphan children. We have so many, the family basis has changed. Are we catering for it? You know, are we really catering for it? I had one of our organizations in the Western Cape, I will not go into the particular, but what concerns me is it's an institution for substance abuse. They have different age groups, but they have one program for everybody. And this is also where, and what happens with that is that say for me, if we just take one person, when that person comes out and he has a relapse, he goes back into that same. And that is where the money also goes, where it could have been used for somebody else if the program were effective and if the follow-up by every other stakeholder were in place, including the community, the parents, the home that person has to go to. So I want to leave you other than the challenge, that we can never give up hope. We have to continue, but we have to maybe continue in such a way that we, although it is sad, but that we brighten up, that we build a society. Let us go pick up that moral fiber of our communities. And I also reach out to the other organizations, Jefferson, like our churches and all of that. Work together, amalgamate our efforts. But thank you very much for your contribution to the public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the presenter for such a touching presentation. It was an eye-opener in many ways. More especially, you touched a point that most of us as parents tend to ignore. Presently, Christmas is a month away. We'll go to ShopRite and all those big shops. We tend to buy plastic guns, plastic swords. That's where we start to brood criminal characters within our little children. They are growing in a society of oppression. So a slight mistake, because they've been growing up with those plastic guns. When they grow up, they will tend to use proper guns, because already they are experts in using all those things. We took a hint from today, as we are all parents in here, not to again buy presents like that. Thank you for bringing up that issue.
Thanks a lot. Will you answer the question, please? The two questions. You don't need to look at the comments. Next, that was mine.
Okay. In response to Honourable Member's first question around how can we properly implement the Act, I'll just give you one example. You know, from us, we've got a legal project where two paralegals assist approximately 350 women per month with protection orders. And they seem to have a very good relationship with the South African Police Services in that they work hand in hand with them. They offer education and training around the Act and the rights of women and children, and they also teach the officers that they work with to be gender sensitive and to be sensitive to women's, you know, women that are survivors of domestic violence. And we've seen that works very well. If there is an instance where a client does not receive the proper treatment, it is taken up immediately with the station commander so that we can make sure that it doesn't happen in future. And just adding on to what you were saying, ma'am, it is for exactly that reason that the Sarki Badman Center exists. We work in partnership with 9 other NGOs on our premises, offering a host of services. And our services expand from day to day and month to month to bridge those gaps that we are seeing within our communities. In the last 5 months, we've opened a new education and training program to cater for children within the schooling system and within communities that are running households, and how they can deal or how they can best run their lives or manage their households or their siblings. We do education within corporate sectors to teach individuals to be sensitive, and the so-called bosses of organizations to be sensitive to the needs of women that are having difficult times in their lives. So from day to day, like I said, we have to amend our program and our approaches so that we are able to meet the needs of the survivors.
just want to also add on to that, we have got children coming to the center in groups. Children that's looking at their future, what they really want to be in life. And I can remember there were children that wants to become social workers, but when they see the work face to face, they decide that they don't want to be in that field. And I think we already have a shortage of social workers, but the children decide there and then that this is not for them, because the hardship, the lives that the children is going through, we allow them to be part in the crèche, to spend time, because they have got this community service that the schools is now offering the children, to go into the field and see how best they can assist and how they can make a change in the life of a child. So that works very well for us. And also we've got other programs like Walanani we got, and they looking at the women's well-being, where they referred women to the clinics for their health reasons and so on, and do they all the different tests that they're looking at. And I think we try to accommodate other organizations on programs, so that we can see how best we can holistically look at families, and also I'm also part of a group, or myself I'm going to different prisons where I run programs with men that is in prison for domestic violence cases. And I start off with at Malmesbury New Prison with about 14 people in my group, and it's now about 45 people in the group, and that for me it's a plus, because I can see that men don't maybe know how to go forward, because we, the bearers of men, we carry them in our bodies, so we need to know best. But men also do their own things, and so we, I feel as a mother that I need to do a contribution to with my society, because I've got male children as well. So it's not that I'm a woman or activist for women, violence against women, but I also feel that I can make a contribution towards men's programs. And so I've been working with men for the past couple of years now, also at Portsmouth and as well as Caledon, and so we can liaise with people. I can remember there was one of the men that was in my group. He was shifted because he got life imprisonment, and he was sentenced to Johannesburg Central. And there's still a communication between us that I can still help him just by chatting to him, just give him some guidelines in life, you know. And so it's little things in life that counts for me, and through that we can change our society. Because if you look at poverty, and when I look at our children, I call them the pavement children and the padlock and key children, because growing up on the pavement when the mom and dad is not there, or the child going into the house alone, scared, lock the door and sit in front of the television, what else is there for us? What do we really teach our children? Because we can't, we're not able to be there for them all the time. So, yes, there's a risk that we need to take. But risk to what? Risk to a child that can be killed at home, a child who can do all kinds of things at home, because you don't know what is the child watching on television, for instance. I mean, by coming in with the media thing. But let's do the small things that we can do, that we can see as a community. How best can we assist? How best can we help?
Thanks a lot for that, Rose. I always believe that if you take care of the little things, the big things normally take care of themselves. And I think, you know, these aspects you brought up, like the twins, I'm glad people are speaking to it. Because yesterday, Professor Van Us spoke to the media, violence when it comes to media, the electronic media, he spoke to that too. And then what is also important is, you know, the computer. And I think someone brought up the computer this morning, you know, the internet, and even the honorable members spoke to it. And when it comes to violence in our society, we come from a violent past. It was discussed fully this morning. But as government, with our organizations, you know, our NGOs, our CBOs, even, you know, the schools, we have to look at the moral regeneration. of our society, and also look at the family unit, family values. And when it comes to, like, within government, we have the integrated approach, and this is an intersectoral approach. And like I said earlier on, sometimes people don't know who is the lead department, but it's very difficult because we will always ask the department, you know, what are you doing? How are you managing it? Sometimes the department will say, I'm not going to speak social development for justice. But officials can't tell us if they are there in that integrated approach. They must have the guts to speak to the department. And then when it comes to, you know, the story, it's empowered me a bit. But being here with the inputs, you know, it's empowering. And I'd like to quote words from our past president, Honorable Nelson Mandela. He said that South Africa will never be liberated or free unless women are emancipated. So we still have a long way to go. I'd like to thank both of you.
My name, can you hear me? Okay. My name is Catherine Foster, and I'm the advocacy officer for REACH, which is Rural Education Awareness and Community Health. Thank you very much to the chairperson and the committee for the opportunity to speak here today and highlight the situation of women living in rural and farming communities in the Western Cape. REACH was founded in 2005 as a response to the high prevalence of sexual harassment, sexual violence, domestic violence, alcohol and drug abuse, and HIV and AIDS in the Western Cape's rural farming communities, and the lack of sufficient programs and services to address and assist those whose lives are affected by these social problems. It is through our holistic approach of awareness raising, training, counseling, and advocacy that we are working with farming communities and rural communities to encourage individuals and communities to become empowered and live free from sexual harassment and sexual violence. It is during our workshops and training where we meet men and women who are committed to ending violence within their communities and their homes. We know that for this to happen, we need to be personally committed and that we need the laws to ensure that our human rights are protected. We are participating in this public hearing and we have participated in the joint submission that you heard earlier from GAP because we believe that the Domestic Violence Act needs to be better implemented. It will be through working together that this can happen. However, it is essential that the voices of women from rural communities who have suffered great loss and pain due to the lack of implementation over the past 11 years of this act be heard. We have met Miss Claudine Dyke through an awareness-raising workshop, and we have since assisted her with counseling, referrals, and advocacy. Over the years, we have also continued to follow up with Claudine and watch her become a survivor. For 2009, Claudine is the face of REACH, as she has faced adversity and embodies our dreams, vision, and goals. As an ambassador for the organization, she is here to tell you about her life as a survivor of domestic and violence and how she did access the law to protect her and her children, but it failed her. It is by her own strong will and the support of REACH that Claudine is alive here today to tell you that victims of domestic violence need protection. It is my honor and my pleasure to introduce Ms. Claudine Dyke.
Okay.
She will be speaking in Afrikaans and then translating to English.
In New York, en ek wil baie dankie sê vir die voorreg wat ek het, dat ek vandag my story met u kan deel. Ek sit hier as 'n vrou wat 14 jaar gemishandel is, lewendig aan die brand gesteek is en geslaan. Ek was 8 jaar getroud. My man het my mishandel, vasgemaak, elke male verkracht, vasgemaak soos hy het wil hee. En my verkracht soos hy dit wil hee. Ek het goeie weg gehad. Ek is matriek uit die school uit. Ek het financiële bestuurder geleef. Ek het gewerk, maar nooit vir myself, want ek my geld afgevat. Would you like to greet everybody and thank the committee for giving her the opportunity to speak here this afternoon, and she would like to say that it's a privilege for her to share a story with everyone. As a woman who's been abused for 14 years, and she was burned alive and beaten by her husband, to whom she was married for 8 years, he would tie her up and rape her as he pleased. She managed to complete education. She finished a matric and studied financial management, and she had good jobs, but she'd never been able to work for herself because her husband would take her earnings.
I get 2 kinders in my envelope, a daughter and a son. As my man my verkracht het, my daughter van 3 jaar oud uit dit was, liefdige by my. Ek het geplikt en versoek wat ek dit in mensen van moet uitvat. Maar wil jylle tek haar het sy moet sien. En so het aangegaan 8 jaar. Sy meisjes wat die haat het in die huis ingebring. Hulle het naweke saam met ons gespend. Hulle het seks gehad saam met sy meisje in ons in my hoofd slaapkamer. As hulle klaar seks gehad het, dan moet ek vir hulle met my tong skoon maak. En my dochter keerde toegekijk.
She has 2 children in her marriage, a boy and a girl. When her husband would rape her daughter, who was 3 at the time, would be forced to witness it. She would plead with him to take her out, but he would want the daughter to witness it. He also had girlfriends that he, during his marriage, that he would bring home and spend weekends at their home. He would have sex with a girlfriend in their bedroom, and after they had sex, she would be forced to clean them with her tongue.
Meisies wat hy huis toe gebring het, ek was gewillig geweest om altyd vir hulle kos te maak, het hulle klere gewas, alles gedoen, want dit is hoe my man gehad het, ek moet dit doen. As ek dit doen, dan word ek geslaan en my dochter is saam. So word het in die jare aangegaan. My dochter was 3 jaar oud geweest. Sy het die notice gevat, die my opgevraagd aan my man. Hy het nie ons het geld gehad om gas te koop, het ek buite vuur gemaakt om kos te maak. En terwijl ek die woord omgedraaid het op die, in die pan op die stoof, het hy my met een groot pak steenvlauw geslaan, my gezicht het binnen in die pan geval. En op daar is dan, was my dochter gedreed na haar ver oud, en die galieblik het omgeval, en ek het binnen in die kolen geleen, maar my dochtertje het my probeer uitdruk uit die kolen, en sy die neibus langzaam gaan boek. En so het het aangegaan, vir 8 jaar, ek was me altyd tevreden, ek het nooit gepraat, want ek was te bang. Ek was politie toe om saak te maak, kan vir my gesê, ek moet aan te dak maak. Aan te dak is useless.
She was always, her husband wanted her to bring food and wash the clothes of the girlfriend, and she always did it because that's what he wanted. And her daughter witnessed all of this all the time. At the time when the daughter was 3 years old, an incident happened where they had no money for gas inside, and she was preparing food on a open fire outside. And as she was busy with the food, the husband hit her with a brick in the back of her head, and she fell into the coals. Her daughter was then 3.5 years old, tried to get her out of the coals and went to alert the neighbors. And the abuse carried on like this for 8 years. She's been to the police, who said that she could get an interdict or a protection order, but it hasn't helped.
I'd enter that cry, and I'd for 3 maanden in die tronk gewees. I'd uitgekom, I'd weer my huis stikkend gemaakt, my penstof. I'd my weer geslaan. I kan my dood gemaakt het in die tijd. Wat is die interdict voor my beteken? Niks. Dit kan my nie gehelp het nie. Net ek besluit, ek kan nie uithoud en ek het geskui.
She got an interdict against him and he served 3 months in prison. But when he came out, he came back to the home and broke down things in the house and also assaulted and beat her again. So nothing, that didn't really help for her. And she then decided to divorce the husband.
So wat na 2.5 jaar het ek weer boyfriend ontmoet. Hy was 'n brandweerman. Die man van my lewe, hy was alles in my lewe, dis wat ek tyd het gedink. Want hy was beter as my getroude man gewees. Hy was 'n pa van my kinders wat hy, sy kinders was. Ja, Lucie het hom opgevreed en hy het my geslaan. Nie mes gedreig, en ek het gedink, nog een man. En het altijd vir my, het was 3 jaar by mekaar, het altijd vir my gesê, tyd het was ek, assistent bestede, die kettingwinkel, het altijd vir my gesê, ek mag met geen vrou praat nie, ek mag met geen man praat nie, ek mag nie met sy pa praat nie, ek mag nie met sy ma praat nie. Ek mag ek vir hulle presente koop, niks. Hy het ook 2 kinders gehad, ek mag ook niks met hulle te doen en nie. As hulle by ons huis kom, dan moet ek vir hulle weg, ja. Ek het nooit gedoen nie. Ek het eindig die pak gevat, as wat hulle die seer in hulle hart moet gaan, dat ek vir hulle moet weg, ja.
After 2.5 years, she met someone again, who was a firefighter. And at the time she thought this was the man of her dreams because he treated her better than her ex-husband. And he was also a father to her children. And they were together for 3 years, but he was a very jealous person and threatened her throughout that time as well. And she thought, again, another time I have to go through this. And at the time she was an assistant manager at the chain store. But he instructed that she couldn't communicate with anybody, with no man, with no woman, not with his mother, his father, with any parents. And he also had 2 children of his own, and he instructed her that she could also not communicate with them, and if they came to visit their house, she had to chase them away. But because she didn't want the children to feel the hurt, she refused to do that and then accepted the beatings that he gave her for that. the part where he told her not to send his children away. He also had two children of his own, and when they would come to visit, she would be instructed to chase them away from the house because she wasn't allowed to have any contact. But she didn't want the children to feel that hurt of her chasing them away, so she would allow them to come into the home, and he would beat her for that. And she would take those beatings rather than have the children be hurt.
Ek het later van tyd uitgevind, hy het ook ander meisies. En ek kom uit 'n goeie huis uit en ek is baie bendig goed gemaakt en ek verkies nie so lewe nie. En ek het besluit, ek gaan met hom praat en vir hom gesê dat hierdie verhouding voorbij is, want ek sien nie kans. Want ek kom daar uit. En dit was op 'n Saterdag, hy het op die bed gesit en het vir my gelag. Hy was besig om te bad. Ek het gesê, so, ek wil met jou praat, want ek sien nie meer verder kans. Ek wil jy met jou goed vat en gaan uit my huis uit, want dit was my huis gewees. Hy het vir my gelag, hy het kom by huis toe gegaan. Ek het gedink, hy gaan miskien kyk of hy deeg toe is of so, of hy gaan een mes weer haal, want sy sien my alle jare gedreig het met een mes. Maar hy het kom by huis toe gegaan en hy het gaan kyk, al die vensters en die deure was toe. En hy het een mes in sy sak gehad. Het kamer toe gekom, ek het uit die paraffinlamp gebruik. Hy het die paraffinlamp gevat, hy het het op die kas gesit.
She later found out that he too had other girlfriends, and she comes from a decent home and wasn't raised to live like this, and decided that she wasn't going to go through it and decided to speak to him. And it was on a Saturday afternoon that she decided to tell him that the relationship is over and she doesn't want to continue. And also because it was her house, she said she asked him to leave her home. And he laughed at her and then went into the kitchen. And she thought he was probably going to fetch a knife or something to threaten her with again, as he usually did. And he went into the kitchen and made sure that everything was locked and came back and did have a knife in his pocket. And at the time, she had paraffin lamps in her house, and she put the knife down. He put the knife down with the lamp.
Hy het op die bed gesit, die bad het ek twee bedens, die bad het is in die twee bedens verstaan. Ek het op die een bed gesit en hy op die ander bed, hy was bezig om te bad te sê, ek moet praat, hy luister. Sê ek vir hom gesê van die verhoudings wat hy het en ek denk is voorbij, hy moet die beste male bly of whatever hy wil doen. En hy het vir my gelag en hy het vir my gesê, ek wil nou net vir jou wees dat ek alle jare ernstig is met dit wat ek vir jou gesê het, so met ander woorde. Dat hy vir my gesê het, as hy my nie kan kry nie, sal niemand die, sal kies my die dood. En ek het so bykie vrees bevangen begin word, maar ek het vir myself gesê, vandag gaan jy stop maak jy aan en dis klaar. Hy is een brandweeg man. En hy die lamp gevat, en ek het gedink hy gaan die lamp aansteek, want die kamergordyne was toe so, die kamer was so bietjie donker gewees. En hy het die lamp afgehaal, en hy het het oopgedraai, en soos ek hier sit, het ek op die bed gesit, en hy het die paraffin op my uitgegooi. Ek was vrees bevangen, maar ek kan nie beskryf hoe nie. En hy het die leite gevat, en hy vir my gesê, ek moet die leite vat. En ek vraag vir my, wat moet ek met die leiter maak? Hy sê vir my, ek moet nie vir my kak praan, ek moet die fucking leiter aansteek. En dan moet ek het doen, die vlambe mense. Ek sê vir my, asjeblief, moet nie dit aan my doen, ek gee my net die kans. Okay, fijn. Ek gaan jou nie los, ek kan enig iets doen. Ek sal alles aanvaar, want ek is baie lief vir jou. En hy het vir my gelag, maar het gesê, jy dank, ek is een pop. En hy sê, strijk die leiter. En ek het die leiter een keer van my vrouw, en ek wil die strijk. Sy mees gevat, het hy my een gat gemaakt. Dat ek gevoel het, hy plik aan my gehoor, dat hy die mees uitgehaal. Dus hy gaan jy die leiter strijk of nie. Sê ek asjeblief toch, dus hy moet my bekou en doen wat hy sê. En ek het die leiter gestrek, maar ek het het weer van my afgehaal. maar hij is voor mij getuind. En ik heb hem aangezet en ik heb hem weer afgezet. En met één stuk klap in mijn hand, die mij, en het was net vlammen geweest. Ik kan niet zeggen hoe lang het was, nee. Ik kan niet beschrijven, maar het was bitter.
On that Saturday when she decided to talk to him, they had two beds in the room with a bath in the middle of the two beds. And she said he was going to take a bath and he would listen to her while he was taking the bath. And he said to her that he's going to show her that he's been serious with what he's been saying all these years, that if he can't have her, no one will. And at that time she became fearful. But decided that enough was enough and she was going to continue with the conversation to say that the relationship is over. And he had gotten out of his bath and opened one of the paraffin lamps, and she thought he was going to light the lamp. And instead he threw the paraffin on her and then took out a lighter and told her to flick the lighter, and she said, why? And she said to her not to question him and just to do as he says. And told her to light her shirt. And she pleaded with him to say, please just give me a chance, not this. And he persisted and then held a knife to her throat and told her that she should do as he says. And she then proceeded to flick the lighter, but far away from her. But he timed her hand, and as she had flicked the lighter, hit her hand against her, causing her shirt to catch a light. And she was then burnt.
Ek weet nie hoe lang ek gebrand het, maar ek het gepleit en gesoek wat in vorm gesê, jy is een brandweerman, jy werk elke dag met sulke mense wat brand, jy weet hoe dit is, asseblief, doe net iets. Ek weet dat ek het gegil en uit die badwater op my uitgegooi. Die vlamme was dood gewees, maar as ek afkyk, gaat dit in my borste gebrand. Ek het vlees geruik wat bak in a pan. Rook het uit my lichaam uitgekom. Die arm, my rechte armdop het afgedop. Was net been en bykie vlees gewees. En ek het gesê, so bel die ambulans, bel vir meneer Brein, die bestuurder by die brandweerstasie. Julle weet wat om te doen, julle help ander mense, asseblief help toch net vir my. En hy sê, ek moet my bekken, want ek het gegil, en hy het my geklap. Toe sy hand weggaan van my gezicht, het my vlees sy hande vastgesit, en het sy hand gevat, en het in my borst afgevreer, en het nogmaals vlees afgedrek. Ek het uitgepaas. Ek onthou het my op die bed neergegooi en het weer badwater gaan haal en het handdoek gepak en het in die bad gesit en het het oog my gegooi. En so het my gelat lee op die bed, uit vir my vir een dag en een nacht toegesluit. My kinders was by my oma gewees, die aand wil huis toekom, hy het vir my vroege tijd gesê, as ek gaan sê, hy het my gebrand, dan gaan hy vir ons verrek maak. En ek het gesê, ach Heere, my kinderse leven is in gevaar en ek is helpeloos. En ek het gedank, die aand my kinders huis te kom en hulle vraag wat gebeur het, uit achter my dochter Tanya gestaan. En het my met oog gekyk wat net ek geweet het wat beteken het. Toe sê ek, dit was een ongeluk, ek het my met kookwater gebrand.
She can't recall for how long she burnt, but she pleaded with him, especially since he was a fireman and knew what to do in situations like this to help someone. But he didn't do anything. He poured bath water on her. And while she was burning, she looked down and holes had burned into her breasts, and it smelled like meat burning in a pan and the flesh on her right arm. He threw the water on her. And she then asked him to call the station commander at the fire station to come and assist because they could still help her. But and she screamed, and instead he smacked her and told her to be quiet, and as he slapped her, the flesh from her face was stuck to her to his hand, and he then proceeded to wipe that onto her chest, causing more flesh to come off. He then poured more bath water on her, and then took a wet towel. She passed out. He then took a wet towel and put it over and left her like that for a day and a night, locked up by herself. And her children were not there at the time, but he threatened to hurt her family if she had told them that he was responsible. When the children came home and they asked what was wrong, what had happened to her, he looked at her from behind her daughter, seeing with his eyes that if she says it's him, that something will happen to them, and then said it was an accident in which she'd burnt herself with boiling water.
So had I in the night with the pain come, I had flow gewak, then weer bijgekomen. I had meer tijd wat ik bij was, ik heb er een 4-5 keer met mijn gemeenschap gehad. Ik boop die handdoek geleerd. Dan heb ik flow geworden, dan heb ik weer bijgekomen. Dan is hij bezig, dan word ik weer flow en voel het aangegaan die hele nacht. Zondag die hele dag. Zondag aand heb ik voor hem gezegd, ik heb honger. Ik kan niet geëten, die van mijn mond was vol blazen. Ik was ook niet honger geweest, maar ik heb voor hem gezegd. Ik heb gevraagd wat moet ik met kleden zeggen. Ik heb een yoga-kje gaan halen. Ik heb dan moet ik proberen spuit in mijn mond niet te spuit. Dat ik net iets in mijn maag kreeg. Terwijl ik dat had doen, dat ik met mijn zieken gezegd. Ze moet tegen de venster staan. En mijn bed het onder aan de venster staan. En ik haas uit dat ze kan dichtkomen. Ze boe op mijn stukken naar boven. Getrapt, afvoet het ingezien. Dat was zeer, maar dat. Dat was de moeite werd geweest, ze heeft mijn leven gered. Ze heeft naar zijn maat toe gehaald in papa tel en ze heeft gekomen naar de ambulance gebeld.
She spent the night in pain, fainting and coming to all the time. But when she came around, he would have sex with her. He would lay on top of the wet towel. And so about 5 or 6 times that night, whenever she came to, she would find that he was on top of her. And then it continued all of Saturday night and the Sunday. And she then told him that she was hungry. And she couldn't eat because she had blisters in her mouth. And he asked what she was like. And then she asked for him to get her yogurt at least because she would maybe be able to get that into her mouth. And when he went to the kitchen, she called her daughter and told the daughter to climb through the window to basically go and get help. And as the daughter climbed out in the haste to get out, she stepped on her breast, which then further injured her because of the wounds, her foot have went into her chest. And the daughter then went to his mother's house and told him what had happened. And the mother then called the ambulance and other services.
De ambulance en de politie het gekomen en vraag wat gebeurt. En ik heb weer eens gezien dat het was een ongeluk. Want ik heb besloten die zaterdag. Ik ga dit ongeluk houden tot ik sterk is om mijn kinderen te kunnen protecteren. Want het wat ik ga doen is betalen en ik blijf achter en we gaan in gevaar wezen. Want als hij in staat is om dat aan mij te doen, dan wat zal hij met mijn kinderen doen. En ik heb gezegd, ik wil het hospitaal toe gaan, want ik is klaar om te dood. Laat ik maar bij mijn kinderen sterf, maar het mij gevat. De politie heeft mij 4 keer gevraagd, was het een ongeluk? En ik heb gezegd, ja, dat was een ongeluk. De kookwater heeft op mij gespat. Dat ik me gezegd, kookwater brandt is zo niet. Ik is, de ambulance is mij gebrand tot op Steenpunt. De helikopter heeft me daar gekregen, want ik heb op al asemal. Tegen de gekomen zone aan dat ik dadelijk de eerste veloogplanting gekregen. Die maandag aan dat ik gehoord, ik moet 7 krijgen, maar dan hoor ik moet nog 6 krijgen. Mijn handen, mijn voeten, alles was toegedraaid, mijn gezicht, alles met mijn oor was, mijn één oor was oop geweest, dat ik een beetje gezien heb. Maar ik kan niet gelopen, ik kan ook niet gevatten. Die woensdag na 11:15 het my dochter gebeld, was sy 11 weg uit. Sy het gesê, mami, hy bly nog steeds by ons, my pa bly by ons in die huis en ons het nog steeds sondagse klere aan, ons was nog geskool toe nie, sy kosie en te zomig en wat moet ons doen, mami, kom maar eens toe. En dit was vir my 'n breuk van.
The ambulance and police then arrived, and they questioned her as to what had happened, and she proceeded to say that there was an accident. She did this for the sake of her children, because if they took her away, what would he do to her children if she admitted that he was the one that was responsible? So for the sake of her children, she kept saying it was an accident, and the police had questioned her about 4 times and kept asking her, was it really an accident? And she just kept saying yes. And they said, well, boiling water doesn't burn like this. So they knew that something was not right, but she didn't want to take that chance. An ambulance then took her to Stanford, from where she was found by helicopter to Tigerberg Hospital. And an arrival here was told that she needed about 7 skin grafts. On the Wednesday night, that was from the Sunday until the Wednesday night, her daughter called to say that he's still in the house with him. Her daughter was 11 at the time. They are still wearing same clothes from Sunday, and there's no food in the house, and that for her was the breaking point.
It's Sunday, Wednesday, and that's the safety. En ek het vir hom gesê, hy is seker nie so onbevredig dat ek hier moet hulpeloos leed, terwijl hy weet, daar is 2 kinders, so wie ek en een pa en een ma moet wees. En ek het gebid dat ek net kan vat, al kan ek ook net kryp, dis al wat ek vraag. Maar ek wil by my kinders wees. Ek het nie gedink om my gezondheid te. My kinders was vir my die belangrikste gewees tyd, op haar stadium. En die vrijdag gekom, het was 20:02 geweest, ek het gehoor, ek leen tegen het hospital in die brandeenheid, my brandwonde was 23%. Die vrijdag 12:02, ek het my seentjie se stem gehoor in die gang. En ek het daar geleid, toe kan ek nog nie lekker vatte, want ek kan nie my selfoon druk. My vingertoppe was al opgemaak geweest, maar my voete was nog toe. En ek het daar geleid, en ek het vir die Here gesê, Heere, ek kom my kinders, en hierdie ma gaan vandag saam. En ek het gehoor my dokter en my kinders het in die gang afgekom, en ek het my probeer gehoor en in die hoog in die geval van die bed af. En ek het gekryp en ek het gesikkeld het by die deurkoesijn, in die tyd wat ek gekryp het, het die wonde getrek, en die wit verband het gooi geraak. Maar die pijn kon my nie gekeer het. En my liefde vir my kinders was groter as die pijn. En toe dokter Piek sien, ek staan op die kusijn net sy flauw geword. Sy sê vir Claudine, hoe kon jy? Sy sê bykom, sy sê, hoe kon jy? Sy sê, dokter Piek, jy gaan vandag huis toe. Sy sê, jy mag jy huis toe gaan. Ek sê, jy gaan huis toe vandag. My 2 kinders gaan nie een voet by die hospitaal uitsit. Sonder hulle ma nie. En ek is toilet en ek het achter het hier gestaan en ek het gesê, Jaha, ek weet, jy is nie so onbevredig dat hulle kan gaan en ek bly achter nie. Jy weet, hulle kom van my af. Hulle ook kom van my af. En het tyd gekom dat hulle kan huis toe gaan en dokter sê, kan nie gaan nie. Toe sê ek, ek gaan nie bly nie. En so as ek het tegenbeeg ek met die rooie kaartje, met ander woord, ek mag nie terugkom as my wonde besoek is. Daar is een ander sisterkie.
From the evening after she'd spoken to her daughter. From the time that she spoke to her daughter, she prayed to God to help her for the sake of her children because she wanted to get back to them, and especially since she's mother and father to these children, and prayed that at least if she could just be able to use her hands, shared 23% burn wounds. And by the Saturday, she heard her son's voice. While she was in hospital, she heard her son's voice down the passage. And she prayed to God just to help her, because she wanted to go home and be with the children. And as she was confined to the bed, and as she tried to get off, she obviously fell, but she crawled to the door, and as she was doing that, the wounds opened up again. And she then managed to lift herself up to the doorway of the hospital room. And when the doctor saw her, the doctor fainted, because she was basically covered in blood again from the wounds that had opened. And the doctor asked her, "How could you do this, Letta?" And she said, she has to go home for her children, and she was willing to go through that pain because the love for her children is that strong. She was then basically released from Tigerberg Hospital with a red card, meaning that she couldn't come back should her wounds become infected.
Ek het gesel en getrip tot onder. Die dokters en die sisters het nog tot onder by die pad saam met my gegaan en geplet en gesobat en as ek het geweier. Ek was saam met my kinders gaan en so het ek gegaan. Ek het alle taal geweier. Hulle was weg. Het was al voor vijf. Het was amper na skemerse tijd. Ek het gegaan en het ek so gesit en gehaak en geskil achter die bosjes, want ek was bang die politie of die ambulance kry me en dan sal hulle my terugvat. En so het ek weer die ouwe gebel wat hulle gedang is. Hulle gegede te by die hospital en ek dacht dat het my kom haal. En ek het daar geleef by die huis. Vir 6 maanden het ek geleef. Ek het vir die Here dankie gesê, al is ek ook nie daar vir my kinders, laat hulle weet ek is hier. Ek kan in daardie stadium niks vir my kinders beteken, ek kan nie vir hulle werk. Daar was geen inkomste nie, hy het nie geld gegeen, hy het nie gehoor nie. My dochter van 11 jaar oud het vir my gehaal bad. Ek het soms 8 begin te bad, soms kwart voor 5 of half 5 het ek klaar gebad. Dat is ek moeg en ek is moeg gehuil, want het was bitter geweest. So het ek vir 6-7 maanden geleden geen maatschappelijke werk het my gehaald. Geen kliniek het my gehaald. Niemand het my gehaald. Ek het myself gezond gemaakt met my dochter zelf. En ek het in my hart, het ek gesê, as ek hier opstaan, dan gaan ek politiestasie toe en ek maak een saak en ek het gedoen. En as het voorgekom op die hof, en hy, ek het geen ondersteuning gehad. As het opkom, dan het hy gelag as ek gepraat het, het was vir my baie hard. Want ek het gedink, miskien, het was een ongeluk, hy het berou, maar hy het die berou nie. Hy het 9 jaar gekry. Hy is in die tronk. En wat ek net kan, 9 jaar. Wat ek net wil sê is, ek het gevraag vir my kinders, want hulle was vir my belangrik. Ek het nie behoopie gaan leen nie. Daar is man, vrouw is as ek. Die vrouw is, daar is man wat die sterk genoeg is om op hulle eie benen te kan staan, want hulle kry nie al van die mense af. En ek het, my kinders het honger gelei en alles, en niemand het vir my gehelp. Ek het van 2002 af tot 2006 het ek onderhoud doorgeloop vir my kinders vir onderhoud, en tot vandaag toe kry ek nog niks. Ek het 2006 het ek besluit, ek waar nie die nie, ek sikkel my alleen. En ek het vir reeds ontmoet, ek het die kursus by reeds geloop. Ek het geen berading gekry nie, maar toe vir reeds ontmoet. Reeds was 3 keer persoonlijk by my in Gansberg gewees. Die ander berading wat ek gekry het was per telefoon. Maar ek wil vandag vir julle sê dat ek is gezond. Daar is nog een beetje hartseer, maar ek is een sterk persoon. My kinders is gezond. En om het kortlijks te stel wat ek was en wat ek vandag is. Ek sit vandag hier as een persoon. Ek bestuur een veiligheidshuis voor haveloze kinders. Ek is een voorstukje madder. Ek het 2 pleegkinders. Ek bestuur een soepkombuis community center. Ek gee naweke 53 hongerkinders kos uit my eie uit.
My inkomste is in die maand 2600 rand, maar ek gee elke Saterdag en elke Sondag by 53 kindertjies kos. En die week wat ek doen, doen ek uit my hartheid, uit ondervinding uit. Ek wil die kinders, my kinders se trane spaar. Die vrouwe, ek is ook beraadig vir reeds. Die vrouwe, ek probeer vir hulle jou. Ek kan het nie, ek is vrou van die jaar, begaan vir 2009, ek is vrees vir 2009. Al die goede wat ek doen ek uit my hart het. Ek is een gemeenskap leier. Ek werk met plus 500 mense per dag. Ek werk 24 uur in die dag. Alles wat ek doen is vir nie. Ek word vir niks betaal nie. En ek krijg swaar, want ek kan het nie alleen behartig nie. Ek gaan municipaliteit doen. Ek gaan maatschappelijke werkers doen. Ek gaan politiestasie doen. Amal bied aan om my te help. Amal beloof hulle gaan my help, maar dit gebeur nooit. En omdat ek weet waardoor ek kom, wil ek graag gehelp wees, want ek wil ander mense help. Want financieel is ek zwak, en ek bly net twee vertrek wendeer is. My twee pleegkinders, het ek op vrijdag, het hulle maar vir my kom sê hulle word, sy en haar twee kinders word, in een kamer, geseks dier haar man, hulle bly op haar plaas. Ek het maatskapelike werke gebel, en ek gevoel, dit mag nie gebeur. Sy sê vir my, sy kan nie nou die saak hanteer, want het is vrijdag, ek moet kom maandag. Ek het besluit, ek kan nie wacht vir maandag. Ek het besluit,
After she left the hospital, she crawled outside and told the nurses and doctors pleaded with her not to go. And her family had already left at that stage, and she hiked along the road, hiding behind bushes because she was scared police would see her and take her back to the hospital, and she was desperate to go home. She then called the person who gave her family a lift, and they turned around to come and fetch her. And she was at home for 6 months, with no income, no support. Her 11-year-old daughter was 11 at the time, then had to birth her and care for her. And she had no, in that time, no social worker or anybody else came to visit her to support her or to see how she was doing. And it took her 6 to 7 months that she healed herself because she was driven to proceed with getting this man convicted or charged with what he had done to her. She went to court. She had no support there. And whenever she would get up in court to make a case, he would laugh at her. He showed no remorse whatsoever. But he was sentenced to 9 years. And she'd also like to say that she fought for her children, and that there's not many women like her who are strong enough to withstand all these things that she's had to go through. And her children have also had to face hardship with all these things. And from 2002 to 2006, she was approaching the maintenance court, but she received no joy there, and she decided to give up on that. She then got into contact with Reach in Gansbaai, where she received counseling and other support services. She and her children, she's still sad, but she and her children are both, she and her children are all healthy, and she's managed to empower herself. She manages a safe house for other children. She manages a soup kitchen. On a monthly salary of 1,600 rand, she manages to feed 53 children every weekend out of her own pocket. And the work that she does comes out of her. She's also a foster mother for two children. And the work she does comes from her heart because she wants to spare other children and women the things that she's had to go through. She's the Woman of the Year for 2009 in the Khansbai region, and she's also a community leader. But she experiences hardship because she can't do everything alone. And she's approached the municipality and police and everyone, but everyone offers and promises that they are going to support, but no one does anything. And she lives in a two-room windy house, so she really doesn't have the capacity to be able to do everything. And the foster children, the mother came to see her because they live in a one-room house, and over the weekends, the father of these children had sex with both the mother and the children in that same room. And she approached the social worker on a Friday, and the woman told her to come back on the Monday because she's not able to deal with this now.
En ek het my phone opgetel en ek het vir Reeds gebel. En Reeds was onmiddellik by my gewees. En ons het al 3 in die nacht het sy kinders gaan haal. Die oudste eniekie kry hulle 2 sissies. Toe die pa nog besig om gemeenskap te het met die oudste eniekie. En ek het hulle gevat en ek het op die hof geveg vir hulle. Alles myne. En die hof het besluit, ek bly in een plakkeskamp, ek bly in een tweevertrek, Wendy, ek verdien geen inkomste nie, hoe kan ek die kinders aanneem? En ek het net gesê, dit gaan nie oor geld of rijkdom nie, dit kom nie uit. En my liefde is oor genoeg vir hulle, en soos my liefde my kinders gedra het, kan hulle vir hulle ook dra. En ek het hulle gekry, ek het die saak gewen. En ek wil net vandag sê, en ek sit vandag hier, en ek wil net vandag, en ek pleit, en ek soeba, gesinsgeweld is een groot probleem, en ons volk kan het nie vat, dat iemand net iets moet doen, en dat ek te jou niks sê.
In the case of the two children, when she didn't get any help from the social worker, she didn't call Reach. I think it was about 2 or 3 in the morning, and they were immediately there, and they went to collect the children. And when they arrived there, the father was still busy having sex with the eldest child. They then managed to remove the children, and she decided to fight for them and went to court, and the children are now in her custody. And the court questioned how she will care for these children considering her own circumstances. But she just feels that she's got enough love and care that she's able to support them. And she'd like to plead that and say that domestic violence is a very big problem. Interdicts and those things don't help, and women cannot continue to face this problem.
Ek wil net dankie vir jy sê, en ek groe nie, jy moet al keer te praat nie, en ons sal na die probleem moet kyk, wat gaan ons doen. Is there any questions, or anything that someone would like to speak about? Because I'm really moved. Honorable member?
Chairperson, it's not an easy matter. Asking questions would really mean frustrating people further. I think the point that is being made with this example is that domestic violence, including women and children, is alive, strong and kicking. What the presentations are not really able to say to us, almost all the presentations, is what mechanisms should we put in place? Or what structures should we put in place that can involve communities, NGOs, government, and other structures? I got a sense that social workers have got an important role to play. But the important role of social workers is merely just to comfort people when they are hurt. To say, this is not the end of the world, we will continue to fight and we will achieve. And it does appear that maybe these issues would need that we engage even much more. I think the Department of Justice is quite necessary to hear these things. I realize someone did all that was said here and got only 9 years in jail. And another one was having it with the child and is having some few years in jail. I'm not sure how many years. It wasn't mentioned. But things continue to happen, and we must really praise the president for his decision to establish this department to unearth all of these things within our society and for us to start seeing where to go. But clearly, Chairperson, the society is not normal. We are not in a normal society. And a lot can be unearthed. Maybe we will have to discuss in a portfolio at a portfolio committee level that after all these presentations that we have received, where do we go from here? And how do we make use of all of these organizations that present to become part of the solution? Because we all identify the problem, and we all must try and find a way through which we can be able to deal with the problem. Legislative framework is not a problem. If we need to amend the legislation, we will do so. That one is not an issue. The biggest issue here is the ensuring that the legislation addresses the actual problem. And we will see that by seeing the effect of what that legislation is to give in changing the society for the better. And Chairperson, I can't ask questions here. All I can say is that in this afternoon, in less than an hour, I am already sitting in a problem where it's difficult to cope. Just two presentations. I'm reaching a situation where I feel like I was in a Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Thanks, Chairperson. My suggestion, I'm sure it's understood, to say we must create a forum where we will involve stakeholders such as the Department of Justice, Department of Police, NGOs dealing with this particular kind of matter, Parliament, in a smaller forum of some kind, but that can be effective. It is an idea that is in me. It is not the position of the Parliament or the Parliament Committee at this stage. This is what develops out of me as I listen to these things, and I'm struggling in my mind to try and find the solution.
I think what is important with this case too, we're accepting, we're writing down, I'll give you a chance now, Patty, that Chris Clough researcher really took down the woman's details and even offer it. Because it's very important, like I normally say, that when it comes to these things, people within our department that's not doing their work have to be dealt with. Because many times a person gets such cases. And to me, what is important, people mustn't come to us. I'm not being now funny about it. Come to us and tell us what is happening, and then we help the person. The departments that's there have to help the people. Because many times a person gets these cases.
And I think we'll take that proposal. And once Pat is back, then you can just complete your recommendation. So we got your details, and I think we have to go into this matter and see, you know, where did we fail. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just have something short to say. Thank you, Rich, for reaching out. That there is an organization that reach out to Claudine, and also to Claudine, to hear revelations like this is also good for us, as I want to believe, is just taking us and giving us the real world, because although some of us live, I mean, if I think of myself, I also live amongst or in an area where domestic violence is visible. A lot of things are going on in all of us, but it is good for us. It keeps us on the ground. It keeps us where we're supposed to be able to serve our people. But I also agree with my colleague that this type of interaction could be just a little, so that we can really look at the individual cases immediately and transfer it to the different departments and different sectors. And then lastly, I want to say, Chairperson, domestic violence and violence is there since the beginning of time. I have to share this with you, because very often we think it's just here, it's now. It's the past 15 years. The new government has never been. It hasn't got anything to do really with the 15 years, the previous apartheid system, the colonialism, because, I mean, the Bible and many other books we read, and when we look at it, it is all about violence. But I hope that I will be able to be part, together with my colleagues and all of us, that we will at least be able to show that we can minimize domestic violence, and that we can really do something about the violence in its complexity and in its whole. Thank you very much.
All right. That's the last speaker, because I think we have to end this discussion. Thank you. Honourable Member from Mpopo, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Very sad. Sad indeed what human beings can do to other human beings. But maybe it comes at the right time, because we are just a few days away from the 16 days of activism. And this year we are saying the fathers of the nation are going to be in the forefront. They say it takes a man to make another man. So as we are appealing to society in general to tackle this monster of domestic violence head on, first, I would like to appreciate my sister here for having had the courage, to come and share. I think history is going to remember you for that. And as we say, working together, we can do more. I believe that's what is actually going to happen. I also believe that the Department of Social Development is still with us here to note what attitudes clients are often confronted with. But I think Chapter 10, God has a reason to make us to be the privileged few that this afternoon we get this type of a testimony. I think maybe we are blessed. But like I said, the approach for this year is that the fathers of the nation are going to be in the forefront, and I believe that together we're going to conquer this monster. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Claudine, I don't have many words for you. I'm deeply hate myself too. But I've written few words of comfort. I write poems, but I just wrote it now as I was sitting here. It's just a short one. The horror I saw made me feel something. The horror I saw made me wonder. The horror I saw made me feel dirty. The horror I saw made me feel like this world was a waste of time. I felt like I was dreaming. It was not happening to me. Decent, respectful, beautiful woman as you are. Does it mean this was a part of growing up? Or was it the gaining of experience? Or was it that I was getting more matured? I am not supposed to relate to others. I think going back to my father, I will be able to know, to say my experiences. But why should the world be so cruel? Why should innocent people suffer? No one will ever know the pain I'm going through, Claudine. The pain and suffering of what was not created by you. I know God will come to my rescue. He always does anyway. And I think, Claudine, all I want to say to you, that as government, with everybody, working together, we are going to do more. Thank you, Claudine.
Thank you. Thank you, Claudine, for coming and sharing today. I'm not going to go through the recommendations that I put up on the PowerPoint, as they're already in the documentations that you have received. And we just wanted to be able to ensure that what we are speaking about today affects the lives of women and children every day, and that it's not just an incident that is one time and it goes away. It's not a broken arm that just heals. It goes on and it affects people's lives. And so we thank you for the time here today to be able to share this. And we look forward to working together and to moving forward, because this is one story that we know that there are many that come from that. So thank you.
I'd like to thank Claudine. And, you know, I just got the document in front of me on the 16 days of episode. And as the National Day of Accountability. Now, I'm not sure if this is the province's theme that I come from. Don't look away, act against abuse. And I think that is important. And thanks a lot for sharing your story with us. And I know we are very unique, because women normally cry. And I think we all felt very bad about it. And I'd just like to say to Jody, because Jody has to speak now, that we rather take an organization to speak to us, because I don't think we'll be able to handle another, you know, input now, you know, from an individual, just with the next, you know, just after the organization. Thanks a lot for that, okay? Where is the Cape Lawyer? I hope you don't mind, Jody, because we need a debriefing. We have to now sit and just organize our brains again, and then we'll be able to handle you. Where is the Cape Law Society? The Cape Law Society.
I'm here, thank you, Chair Lady. Chairperson, is it in order if I sit here, or would you prefer me to come to the front? No, I won't be using PowerPoint, I'll just be speaking. Thank you. My name is Sandra van Staden. I represent the Cape Law Society. I think that it's probably a very opportune time for me to speak, because the core problem that we find in implementing the Act and assisting people with getting restraining orders and implementing them is the biggest problem that everybody experiences is the police and the people who have to implement the Act and the orders are not properly trained. They are aware of the Act, however, they are not fully trained to import to the complainants all the rights that they have. They don't comply with the orders fully, and very often even having an order doesn't really assist the complainant. Because they don't know the Act fully and understand the Act fully, they don't explain to the complainants who now have this order what exactly to do so that they can implement it, and this causes the assaults and the abuse to just continue. Also particularly problematic is the fact that very often even the magistrates are not fully trained in implementing the Act, and they tend to give orders which are fall outside the ambit of the Act. For instance, there is emergency monetary relief can be ordered in where there is financial abuse. But often the orders that are granted are of such a nature that it's almost permanent maintenance orders that are granted. Because the orders are granted on an ex parte basis, which means that the respondent doesn't get a hearing, what happens is that whatever the complainant asks financially is granted to them, and the time period which often is it takes before the interim order can be made final runs into months. And this is because of the unavailability of magistrates, the clogging of the court. So it causes very much a maintenance order to be put in place, and that can cause hardship for the respondent on which the order is to be effected. The other problem which we encounter often in practice is that another type of order that falls outside the ambit of the Act is when the courts make an order denying the respondent contact with the children, or denying the respondent. It's framed in a sense which doesn't deny him contact with his children, but he's prohibited from coming near the complainant. He's prohibited from coming near the children of the complainant or the resident. And that, in effect, means that a father can be deprived of seeing his children. Again, because of the problems that we have with getting the matter heard finally, that causes almost what we can term contact orders to be put in place. The orders are generally granted as a an interim order, and then there is a final date given, which can be anticipated, which means that the respondent can give 24 hours notice to have the final hearing. Because of the courts being so clogged, no effect is actually given to that particular section. So the problem really comes down to the system not working. And I know that it is it's a common problem that is often voiced, and I know that the core of this problem is how to put systems in place and structures in place to improve the effectiveness of this Act. I can't emphasize any stronger the lack of training that there is in the different categories of people who have to implement these orders. And if I'm asked where should we start, I think that would be by training in the police and training in the courts, the Department of Justice. It is, I think that workshops for the people who have to implement the Act and implement the orders are probably, in my view, in our collective view, the place where we should start. Because if these orders are given effect to, as they should, then we won't hear so many of these stories which we've just heard. And if the people out there who commit these heinous acts against women know that these orders are going to be implemented properly, we have the trained people who are there to implement, then it will be so much more of a deterrent. Possibly that will reduce the violence against women and children. And so if I can just repeat myself again, please look into the training that is given and give more time and money to training these people and to unclogging the courts so that we can have these matters heard. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you for that, the Cape Law Society. I think earlier today they had quite a long piece on justice, and you know, training was put in, and I thank for that. We're not going to ask any questions, no comments, we just, of course, it's getting a bit late. We're going to ask Jody to give her input, her individual input. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm not going to take up much of your time, but I, having listened to the stories that I've heard today, can you imagine that disabled people face the same crises, but they're not in a position to escape or to get help? And I am a victim of domestic violence as well. And people with disabilities basically cannot access these services because they don't have transportation at hand, and then they don't have places of safety that they could be removed out of an abusive situation, you know, that they see themselves in because of the socioeconomic conditions that they live under. 99% of our people live on grants. Where would they go? If they had to complain or take action against the abuser, where do they go? So those are major problems that people with disabilities face. And if statistics had to be taken of how many crimes against disabled people are reported, I don't know if you even get 1%, because they are too afraid to come forward. If they do, they would have no other place to go. And 3 weeks ago, I was in that situation. And I went around looking for a... Well, I charged the man that I was living with. I took a court order. I didn't go for the protection order. I had a court order taken to him where I had my things removed from there. And I went looking for a place to stay. And as soon as people see you on a wheelchair, nobody wants to give you a place to stay. And one lady actually had the audacity to tell me, I don't like seeing crippled people in my yard. It's a nightmare. And the other point I wanted to say is that I think domestic violence should be categorized a high priority crime, and stricter sentences should be handed out to perpetrators of the crime. If I just look something. And domestic violence is a condition, it's not a cause. And as long as we focus on the condition, we're never going to sort out the problem of domestic violence. We need to put more emphasis on the causes of this, because it's a cyclic condition. And like I said, more emphasis could be placed in the causes, then I think the problem would be alleviated. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Sorry? No, alcohol is just a scapegoat.
Yes.
It's never the thing.
Thanks a lot, Chowdy. You can put up your mic. And you are correct, because today we looked, you know, we said we have to gather root causes of domestic violence. The next one would be Women Legal Center. And you can just give us your name, please. Yes?
Hi.
Putting your mic.
Hi,
hello everybody. Hello, Chairperson. My name is Sherith Sanger, and I'm an attorney. Sherith, C-H-E-R-I-T-H, Sanger, and I'm an attorney at the Women's Legal Center.
I just want to start out by saying thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to come here today and make oral submissions around the implementation of the DVA by the police and the courts, and also thank you to the rest of the committee. I'll try not to take up too much of your time. I know it's been a very strenuous day, and hearing the stories there today, no matter how many different domestic violence cases I deal with or what I hear, it's still really scary, and I couldn't stop myself from crying because it's really emotional. So I know we're all taking a lot of strain, so I'll try not to spend too much time on what I have to say today. Just a little bit of background on the centre very quickly. The Women's Legal Centre is an independently funded law centre. We're a non-profit organisation. Most of our funding is secured from overseas funders and certain individuals. We were established in 1999 by a group of women lawyers. That was shortly after the coming to operation of the Constitution. And the purpose of setting up the centre was basically to develop the laws relevant to women in terms of the Bill of Rights, or the rights contained in the Constitution, in other words. Our core function is to litigate impact cases. By that I mean we do strategic litigation. So we take on specific cases with specific sets of facts to attack a problem with the law or to change the law, basically with the view of improving the law for women. We do our work in specific areas which include land law, labor law, access to health, marriage and relationship rights, and then gender-based violence. By that, of course, I mean sexual violence and domestic violence, which is a big part of our work. We also do advocacy work in those areas around training and educating people and so on about their rights. And then we also provide a legal advice service, which is not one of our core functions. We've got one designated legal advisor who sees women. She's one of our paralegal. And for 2008, I know it doesn't sound a lot, but in looking at what the main work is that we do, she saw something like 1,500 women alone as an individual last year. And the vast majority of those client queries related to domestic violence. So I'm just trying to illustrate the extent of the work that we're dealing with this, because most of the recommendations and problems that I highlight now is our own experiences. So I'm not saying that this purports to be a complete assessment and highlighting all the problems relating to the courts and the police in terms of the Domestic Violence Act. So the Women's Legal Centre, we have made submissions, or contributed to a joint submission with a group of other civil society organisations. And in there, I've set out the problems and highlighted and set out recommendations in detail. So I ask you to please refer to that at a later stage to, you know, bring into effect what I'm going to be talking about today. Generally, I just want to start out by saying that we have identified that the courts and SAPS failed to comply with their duties as prescribed in the DVA, or by inefficiently executing these duties, and that some provisions of the DVA are inefficient to give effect to the actual purpose of the Domestic Violence Act as set out in its preamble, which is to afford survivors of domestic violence the best possible protection that we can give them, and then obviously ultimately to eradicate gender-based violence in the country. So just to talk, I want to mention a few things that I thought was important in relation to the implementation of the Act by the courts. One of the big things was that we've had clients that have said, quite a few clients actually have come in and said that they would go to court to see a domestic violence clerk and they won't be seen to on that particular day. You may have heard about this earlier. What happens is that the courts, the magistrates' courts, are saying that till a certain time in the day they will be seeing women. And for the remainder of the day they'll be having protection orders issued by magistrates. This is quite a common problem at a range of different courts, particularly in the Western Cape, because that's all I can speak of, because most of our clients are from here. And we're saying that we need more domestic violence clerks to address this issue so that the court can spend more time on seeing women. And also that these sorts of matters should be dealt with as a matter of priority, particularly looking at the gravity and the seriousness and the high frequency of domestic violence. It's just something that we're having difficulty in understanding as to why women can just be sent away. The second thing in relation to the courts is that women are saying, I'll refer to women and complainants, I'll use the terms interchangeably, have been saying that they're treated very insensitively by both domestic violence clerks as well as by magistrates. This is also a big concern because it has an effect of re-traumatizing women opposed to empowering them and assisting them. And what we're saying here is that there is that more training needs to be done, particularly around gender consciousness and gender-based violence, and exactly what the impact of that is on women. much more needs to be done, extensive training, continuous training, because we need to improve that service, because it also has the effect of making women not want to come forward for assistance. This seems to be the perception a lot in communities. The next thing is that domestic violence clerks are not informing complainants of the right to lay a corresponding criminal charge, such as assault or whatever the relevant Domestic Violence Act may be. They're not informing women of this. And what we're recommending is saying that perhaps we should use this within the actual court procedures, where magistrates should be informing women of this right as well during the procedures where they actually are considering finalizing the interim protection order. To create that or make provision for that in the Act may be a better way of dealing with it, to ensure that women are aware of their rights and the options available to them. Because we're happy that there's a civil remedy, but using criminal law as well would be highly beneficial for women. The next one I have here is about legal representation. Complainants often cannot put a proper case before the court when the court considers the finalization of an interim protection order. And this is specifically in circumstances where the respondent has employed the services of an attorney. We're saying that legal representation should be given to women. Where women cannot afford an attorney, legal aid, we're saying expand their mandate. It's important that we do this because interim protection orders are not being finalized on this basis, that women are not in the position due to a lack of understanding of the procedures or just the intimidating nature of the court process in itself. They're not putting out a proper case before the court. And it's important that they are doing that so that we can secure more protection orders and they have something to enforce protection with. So that's something that we're recommending quite strongly. Then also in relation to magistrates' powers, we're saying that magistrates' powers should be extended to allow magistrates to actually subpoena witnesses. As in any court proceedings, it's very difficult to get a witness to actually come and testify. And sometimes witnesses fear retaliation from the respondent or fear being seen as an outcast by the community by speaking out about these things, or because they see it as a family matter that doesn't concern society generally. So we say if they can subpoena witnesses, it's something that could be very positive. And once again, in supporting the complainant's case. Okay? So that's our other recommendation. Another one relates to magistrates again, and also their powers are quite limited in terms of protecting the safety and well-being of complainants. We're saying that the power should also be extended to basically order that a particular SAPS member or the station commissioner of a particular police station actually is ordered to investigate a matter or a particular situation where the magistrate is of the view that the complainant's well-being and safety is at risk. We're then saying that the station commissioner, be it that the station commission appointing particular SAPS members to attend to these investigations or just overseeing the process, needs to report back to the magistrate. And we think that that's something that's quite important. And in circumstances, and this may sound quite heavy, but I think that it's necessary and that we need to perhaps be even more radical about the recommendations and things we're going to do to change things. And I'm saying that because it's a court order, and if they fail to do so, then we're saying that they should be held in contempt of court and should be liable for imprisonment or a fine on conviction. A lot of these things that I'm using here, there was a protection of harassment bill relating to violence against women as well, but for women who fall outside of the ambit of the Domestic Violence Act. And I recommended these changes be made to the Domestic Violence Act as well, to create some sort of consistency. So a lot of these same things I'm raising here, because it's arguments that we feel quite strongly about that would assist the process around implementation. Then another one in relation to the SAPS, as we know, and I'm sure this has come up earlier, in relation to them not serving the interim protection orders on the respondent or by delaying in doing that or even on serving warrants of arrest and arresting the respondent, we're saying that we need to have something in place where people are held liable when they don't do that, because this can have dire consequences for complainants. And I've got cases where this has actually happened. So we're saying in those circumstances that service, once again, the magistrate, we're saying, should either directed to the station commissioner of the relevant police station, who should then identify individual SAPS members and say that service is your responsibility. And that if it's not done as they're required to in terms of the provisions of the DVA in Section 2, I think, we're saying that they should be held responsible for that and that steps should be taken against them. And that would once again have the effect of a court order. So so, there would be contempt of court in them failing to do so. And I haven't made the same recommendation around contempt of court in relation to all the submissions, as specific ones, and I think there's a great necessity to do that. Then the last one that I have in relation to the courts is that SAP's members are also failing to confiscate firearms and dangerous weapons from the possession of the respondent, which I suppose has come up as well. And that is already legislated in terms of the provisions of the DVA. And we're saying that in this situation that they must be held, that because it would form part of the conditions attached to a protection order, we're saying that there should be the contempt provision included there as well. Because this is a very serious thing, because it means that when respondents continue being in possession of dangerous weapons and firearms, that there's a continuous risk posed at the complainant. And it's basically facilitating a process and not protecting the woman against further harm or abuse. Then in relation to I know that there were some things I couldn't separate in terms of the courts and the SAPS because they're very closely linked, but now I have a few specific things I'd like to mention in relation to the SAPS. In terms of the SAPS, this has also probably come up before about registers recording domestic violence incidences. It's not being done. And what he's saying is that it needs to be done. The station commissioner should actually inspect these registers regularly. And they'll be able to identify which police officers on duty at a specific time and will be able to tell, you know, if they can pick up where somebody was not doing what they're supposed to do. Internal procedures need to actually be followed through and really followed through, not situations where, you know, something is reported and nothing happens about it, because this is also a situation that we're faced with. So I'm saying that really needs to be followed through one, because we need to know, we need it to be recorded, because this is the problem with identifying it. Then also in terms of, this is a very big thing and actually something we're working on in relation to imminent harm in Section 8 of the Domestic Violence Act, where it provides that a South African Police Service member can arrest a respondent where the complainant approaches the police with a valid protection order but without an issued and valid warrant of arrest, saying that harm is imminent, that my partner or my father or whoever the case may be is going to harm me if he's not arrested, or please assist me. Police members are not arresting these people. It's either due to them not fully understanding the imminent harm provision because they haven't received proper training on it, or just being or neglecting to do so, or just not really understanding the possible consequences to the complainant by them not arresting them. So I think this is a big provision that needs to be worked on around training. And what I can also recommend, what I think would work, is expanding on the definition of imminent harm, or basically adding on factors that need to be considered in deciding whether a particular circumstance amounts to imminent harm. There's been an issue where police members are saying they don't arrest the respondents because they fear that they will be liable for wrongful arrest. And this is actually not true, because I've spoken to people and they're saying it's not the case around these situations. But they're using this around the discretionary aspect, because there is some discretion. So in order to maybe work on this discretion, or in them exercising it properly, I think we could add particular factors that need to be taken into account. And those would include, for example, looking at the history of domestic violence. Because it's not records, we cannot use that. But in circumstances like this, I say that the complainant story is efficient. And listening to whether there has been a history of domestic violence. And then secondly, looking at the nature and the extent of the alleged imminent harm or the possible harm that could be caused. Also then, by looking at the likelihood of the occurrence of the harm, and lastly, possible consequences that harm could cause. So adding on, and I mean, this is not a closed list, I'm saying there could be more things we could add on just to make it better and have a better understanding and to ensure that respondents are being arrested. And I've got cases like this where one of our clients' daughters have been murdered by her husband because the police failed to act in terms of the imminent harm provision. So these are the types of things that I'm looking at around that. That's very important. Then the second last one, which I have to deal with, is once again around the SAPS members treating women very insensitively. And from what I hear, I think it's actually worse. The treatment given to women is worse by SAPS members than in the courts, even from what women are telling me. And I think it's once again very important that training is given on gender consciousness, extensive training, continuous training, and that there's a watch, you know, that there's some sort of watchful eye over the dealings with women. And the training is, once I stress that, that is really, really important. I know that things are not going to change overnight around consciousness issues, but I do believe that the process needs to start properly somewhere and that not enough is being done around that. So that's really important. And the last one that I want to mention relates to the SAPS failing to do what they need to do, also in terms of Section 2 of the DVA, in relation to providing or for assisting complainants in finding alternative shelter, and also in relation to collecting their property from a shared residence or a residence where the respondent has access to or is accessible to them, as well as medical treatment. So they're not doing these things in a lot of the cases. And I'm not talking saying that all police SAPS members are doing, but majority of them are not. And we can, I can say this from, you know, dealings with other my NGO partners and the people who deal with domestic violence. They're not doing these things, and I think that in this case, internal procedures once again need to be followed through on. It's very difficult in these circumstances to propose that specific criminal liability or another form of liability is imposed, because there are other remedies in law like damages claims and those sorts of things that can be used. But that is a summary of the things that I felt I should highlight here. But as I said, it's dealt with in more detail in the written submission. Thank you. Yes, we do. Okay. No, I don't know everything, so...
thank you very much, Jefferson. Just one or two. One is the issue of protection order versus imminent harm order.
Okay.
Do we have an order called the imminent harm order?
No, there's not. Okay, would you want to finish first?
Do we have such an
order? No, we don't have a separate order. It's just a provision in the Domestic Violence Act that says that there are circumstances under which South African Police Service members can actually arrest respondents without the complainant being in possession of a warrant of arrest. Because the procedure is usually that once there's a protection order in place, let's say it's a final protection order, and if the respondent contravenes or fails to comply with the conditions as set out in the protection order, that the complainant must then approach the court first to have the warrant of arrest signed and issued by a magistrate.
Yes.
So with the harm is imminent, we're saying the provision says that they must arrest.
Don't you think that the proposal is needed for an amendment, not only in this act, but also in the police act, to have an order of that nature included? And I'm saying this, Chairperson, because I am a victim myself. I have lost my daughter, who was killed by a boyfriend because she was no longer interested in him. And they started fighting a couple of days. She went and obtained a protection order. And the boyfriend was not arrested. And the boyfriend continued, in the presence of that protection order, continued to kill my daughter, and the case was then opened. The guy is serving a life sentence, but my daughter is dead, and dead for good. I'll never have her again.
Sorry,
Now, this kind of imminent order, I suggest that we find a way through which we can be able to amend the act to say where there is a potential for imminent harm in between. That order, there must be an order that allows police to immediately arrest.
I agree with that completely. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important that we do that. That's a good way of doing it in relation to the Police Act as well.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I appreciate that generally there is a problem of men harassing, abusing, and oppressing and doing all kinds of bad things to women. But is it not time we realize that there are women doing the same to men? And therefore we could perhaps look at this thing in the form of a gender.
Okay.
Whether or not men remain part of our society, and they'll be for the rest of the existence of this society. If we're building a society where we exclude them, the potential exists that somewhere there we will be needing them, and they'll be far away from where we are.
Yeah.
And we will then have to revert and start doing acts for men. You know, the same exercise, but for men. to try and take them on board. Why are we not taking everybody on board now?
Can I respond to that?
Oh, perfect.
But we discussed it earlier on too, because we tried to get men here.
Okay.
Because you have men for change and all that. You know, just to come and speak. Yeah. But you know how men are.
Just to say one thing. I understand what you're saying, and I think it's a very good thing about moving towards a general human rights consciousness. But I think that the reality is, and that statistics have indicated, and this is statistics conducted by people who deal with domestic violence all the time, that a very small minority of men are subjected to domestic violence. And I'm not, it is happening, I understand that, and perhaps men, because it is our issue of masculinity, are not coming out and speaking about it more. But I think that the vast majority of complainants or survivors of domestic violence are women, and that should be our main focus now, particularly because women still constitute a very vulnerable group of people who are specifically vulnerable to violence and abuse and all of these things. But I get your point around moving towards a general human rights consciousness. And in relation to roles being reversed, I think that this is something that people often also deal with in relation to the concept and life, the just general concept of what feminism is about. And it's not about us wanting power. I think it's about just wanting equality. And it doesn't mean that we want to abuse men or become men or take on the actual negative stereotypes and negative aspects of masculinity. And that's also something I just think it's very, very important, because these matters are often misconstrued and taken out of context, and it's, you know, I think that's important. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hate talking when I'm sitting down. I think because I'm short anyway. good afternoon, and thank you so much for the opportunity. Particularly, I know it's very late, and having heard some of the testimonies, I can imagine how people are traumatized. I am not going to go into details. First, let me introduce myself. I'm Fiona. I'm the program director of the Toyando Victim Empowerment Program. And Toyando, I think, couldn't be further away from Cape Town and still be in South Africa. Mm-hmm. We're diagonally opposite.
Yes!
Good on you. Okay. You've heard the trauma story, the traumatic stories, and there are indeed millions of them. And as was said, this is part of history, that it's always been there. And it unfortunately probably always will be there to a certain extent, but there are things we can do to control it. My submission to the committee is that basically the protection of the system is the problem. You asked earlier, sir, what structures do we need to put in place to put a stop to this? And the tragic truth, or perhaps the good news, is that there are plenty of structures. The structures are there, but they are being abused and they are being perverted. And they are being used to protect the wrongdoers instead of to expose and put an end to what is going on. Now, I'd like to give you just a couple of examples. It is our belief from Toyando victims, incidentally, we've dealt with over 10,000 cases of domestic violence and sexual assault since we opened our doors in 2001. So we speak with a lot of experience behind us. And we have taken the stance that we need to... Okay, let me not dive... I'm trying to keep it short. Okay. The main thing, short and simple... Thank you very much. Without citizen oversight, people don't do their job. South Africa has the most wonderful laws and policies that any organization such as ourselves could ever dream of having. And believe me, we mix a lot with our colleagues up north, and they are so envious of us. And I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a very learned person, I'm only somebody with experience, okay, on the ground.
But it seems to me that although there are certainly a few gaps that have been identified that need to be addressed, frankly, if we were to implement what is there, the situation would be vastly improved. But, for example, if we look at the police force, we all know that they need training. It has been voiced many times. But, dear God in heaven, they need to be held accountable for what they do. You can't blame everything on lack of training. A police officer who is rude to a woman knows very well that he is not allowed to be rude to a woman. He knows that he has to open a case. But what is happening at the moment is that they are blatantly disregarding the act. And they're doing it with equanimity, knowing that they will be never held accountable. And I am going to give you one or two examples of this. The Victim Empowerment Conference in Polokwane last year, was it the year before? It was publicly stated in front of hundreds of people by a senior superintendent of the police force in his uniform. And these are his exact words. Come on, Fiona, you can't expect us to open a case of rape for every woman who complains and claims to have been raped. We have to first prove that she's not lying. And all the police that were there endorsed what he said. Okay. We have witnessed this over and over again. A man rapes a woman, he's given bail. Well, lawyers will tell you that that is also questionable, because it's automatic bail, whereas it's not supposed to be, but it is. Okay? He commits a rape, he's given bail. He then goes and threatens the woman that he has raped, threatens to kill her, threatens to burn her house down. She reports it. The police go and visit him, and they tell him, naughty boy, you must stop this, you know, you're not allowed to do that. They're supposed to rearrest him immediately, and he goes to jail immediately because he's contravened bail. But they don't do it. So what happens? He stabs her to death on Christmas Day 7 times. Okay? Now, what happens to those police? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. You ask the police force, okay, here's a 5-year-old child. The clinic has sent the child to the police station because the clinic nurse has noticed that this 5-year-old doesn't only have current scars on her, or wounds on her vagina. She has scars. Now, you don't have to be educated to know that a scar means that this isn't the first time. Okay. What happens at the police station? 2 police women examine the child's vagina. Lawyers will tell you how many laws that contravenes. They examine the child's vagina, decide that she hasn't been raped, and send her home. Refuse to open a case. The one honest policeman who tries to get the case opened by going to the prosecutor in desperation gets seriously disciplined and transferred away from home. So he's now off in the bush out of Bandelierskop next. Okay. So what I'm saying is that we have these wonderful laws and policies and whatever. We don't have a policy framework, which is the biggest problem. The Department of Social Development has been given this task. You know, seriously, we don't need the touchy-feely people to deal with things like this. They've been sitting on it for years. So it means there's no norms and standards for training. We keep talking about training. What training? And you know the way the training is conducted. I mean, people are pulling the wool over your eyes every day. Yes, these police were trained. What they don't tell you is that, first of all, the ones that went for training were the people that were available. Oh, come on, you go to that workshop today. You know, even if they're not frontline. Secondly, nobody assesses them to find out what have they already been trained on 6 times. What are the gaps? What do they still need to know? So there's no baseline done. So then they attend a workshop for a few days, and at the end of it all, nobody ever dreams of evaluating what they've learned. And having attended some of these things, I can tell you that it's amazing how few people attend workshops, but how many turn up at lunchtime. Okay, we all know this is going on. All right. So they've had a few days away from home, and they've sat in their hotel room watching DVDs, and now that little box is ticked, we've trained 10 people from that station. Would we do that with our teachers? Would we do that with our doctors?
So why are we doing it with our police? Why are we even doing it with the judicial system where we're not assessing what their shortages are? Now, when it comes to oversight, we are in the horrible, horrible position. We are trying to ensure that in a rural place like Toyando, these wonderful policies and laws are being implemented. By trying to do that, we're labeled anti-government. How can we be anti-government for trying to introduce the laws and the policies and get them implemented? Okay? How? These people that are undermining us all, undermining our government by not implementing, they are the ones that the minute we expose them, oh, you're anti-government. You must be working for the opposition. Do you know how hurtful that is? Do you know that as a result of us trying to implement our government's policies, we have been blacklisted to the point that less than 3% of our funding comes from government? That is how, that is what we have to face. I get death threats. I get slandered publicly the whole time. Okay, now I'm not here to complain about me. What I'm trying to say is I'm appealing to you to get a couple of messages through to different departments. Number one, I don't know how many police we have in South Africa, but there's, I think, over 100,000. I mean, I know it's a huge, huge, huge number. Nowhere in the world can we have such a large number of people without having a few rotten apples. I don't believe that we judge a department according to a few rotten apples. Frankly, I've got some in my organization, too. You know, it's a fact of life. What we judge them on is what you do when they're exposed. If you all link arms and protect them and condemn that member of the public that came forward to report that police officer, then immediately what happens? The public realize we can't trust you. We can't report. Do you see what's happening? We need to get the police to acknowledge that they do have some rotten apples and that if they address them firmly and properly, the only result will be positive. They will win the support of the community. And we all know that without community support, you're not going to end violence of any sort. The same, exactly the same applies to the justice system. We have, okay, two quick examples, okay? A control prosecutor in Toyando, okay? One of the most senior ones there. A police officer is charged with raping his two children over a period of a number of years. He is granted bail. The family, the mother and the two daughters, weren't even informed that he's been granted bail. So the first thing they see is this man coming in their garden gate. Can you imagine what that did to those two children who have finally had the courage to speak out against their police daddy? Now, we as TDP, we phoned the control prosecutor and we said, what is going on? You would not believe what this man said to him, and I swear before God this is what he said. He said, what do you mean they're being re-traumatized? They've already been traumatized. How can they be more traumatized? I was dumbstruck. Then he said to me, if they claim they're being traumatized, they must come and convince me. Then I will stop him from being at home. How do you work with that? We complained about it. Nothing happened. We get blacklisted because Toyando Victim Empowerment is complaining about a prosecutor. 5 years later, the same man, there's a case where a case of domestic violence, the woman ran to the police station with her baby. She begged them to go and do something. She'd had to leave her two sons at home. The police didn't do anything. It dragged on, it dragged on. Eventually, the message came out to the police station where she was still there with her baby that her husband had killed the two children with a spade. He'd hacked them to death with a spade. The same control prosecutor gave this man bail on the basis that he did such an important job. Do you know what his job was? He was a school teacher. This man who had just hacked to death two children was released to go back to school. in a town like Toyanda where everybody knows everybody. Can you imagine how those children were traumatized at the school? The point I'm trying to make is please let's just implement what we have and hold people accountable. And there is a strategy, there is a structure in place to do that. It's all there. The only problem is it needs to be realigned. That structure is called the Victim Empowerment Program. At the moment, it is being used. Let me tell you this. Victim empowerment volunteers are trained to be lay counselors. They sit in the police station and they watch the abuse by the police. But their masters, the people that those volunteers report to, are their own victim empowerment committee, which is led by the police. Okay? It's led by the police and social development. So this structure, this victim empowerment structure, has become a structure through which free labor is being used to provide services, statutory services that the government is supposed to provide, i.e. counseling. It's totally ineffective. In fact, it's dangerous because somebody who's been trained for 2 days is really not fit. And they don't want to acknowledge their own weaknesses, so they won't refer. They won't say, look, this is a bit beyond me, I need to refer you to a professional counselor. They even enter into marriage guidance counseling. Now, come on. You know, a 25-year-old young man who's done 2 days of lay counseling is now trying to marriage guidance. Okay? If we can realign the victim empowerment program so that it does what it's supposed to do, what we need is that victim empowerment program to be taken away from social development so that there is a reporting system that can have some effect instead of it all being covered and protected. I mean, a 7-year-old child that was raped went to the police station. The police opened it as a case of common assault. We ask why, and I think we all know that it's now accepted the policy that particularly in rural police stations, because the onus is put on the police station to reduce the crime, the rape statistics, police are simply openly admitting that they're not opening the cases. They will negotiate a settlement between the abuser, a financial settlement between the abuser and the abused. That is their way of reducing rape statistics. In this particular case, the 7-year-old, we were trying to trace it so that we could follow up. And we discovered it had been opened as common assault. And I asked the station commander what is going on. And he explained, oh, it's for their promotion. They believe they're going to be... Well, in fact, the man was promoted. He wasn't disciplined. He was promoted. Okay. But the point is, the Victim Empowerment Committee was there. And I asked them, I said, did you know about this case? And the coordinator said, oh, yes, you know, I was there when the child was brought in. So I said, and you know that no rape case was open? She said, yes, I know. And I looked at her and I said, Anne, what did you do about it? If you had seen the look of indignation and shock on her face, it was like a drama on TV. What? Me? What do you think I must do about it? It hadn't occurred to her that she's actually there to address this kind of challenge. Well, I later discovered that her husband is a policeman there. Okay. The committee is comprised of policemen and social workers. And they're all protecting each other. So look at that. To give an answer to you, the structure that I firmly believe in, that I firmly believe it's already there. It's underfunded. And it's in the wrong place because they got to the stage, and I will tell you this, although I'll probably get in trouble for it. There's a lot of money with the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime to promote victim empowerment. They have told me off the record that, I suppose that means I can't say it.
Yes.
They have said that the minute they mention advocacy or oversight, as a duty of the victim empowerment volunteers, they are shut down and told, leave it alone. They don't want those volunteers to be there for the victim. Now, my suggestion is, or our suggestion from TVEP, have somebody look carefully at the Victim Empowerment Program, because I promise you, it has the ability, by mobilizing citizen oversight, okay, to ensure that these wonderful policies are implemented. But it has to be structured in a way that instead of having these volunteers sitting there patting people on the back while they continue to be abused, those volunteers are supposed to be victim advocates. They're trained to be there standing for the victim. When a woman comes in or a child comes into the station, she's just been gang raped or she's just been beaten by her husband or had a gun put to her head, she can't remember her rights even if she knows them. She can't make demands. She's in a state of trauma. That is where you have the victim advocate, whose job it is to make sure that her rights are realized. And then as the process goes on, to empower that woman so that in future she can stand up for herself. But right then, when the incident has happened, she needs somebody on her side. And as a last word to you, because I'm guilty in that I'm so passionate about this topic, I've done it for 9 years, I could regale you with stories forever. You don't need that. You need a way forward. Please, look at where the Victim Empowerment Program is. Look at what its mandate is. And I'd like to point out something to you. Was it early this year or late last year? The Victims' Charter was launched. We have heard, and it was 7 years in the drawing, okay? We have been told that more money was budgeted for that Victims' Charter to be launched in Parliament than was allocated to teach the people of South Africa about the Victims' Charter. Now that puts it right where the problem is, Ned. People need to know their rights, and victimized, traumatized women and men need to have somebody standing there for them in that initial moment. It's all there for you. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
Yes, you do. And I'm sure they know you. And I think the only thing that you've got to accept, because you've got RPL, you have to recognize that
yes.
Because that's how we are not
asked. Is it? Because I've only got a standard 8 and I need to do something about it.
That's right. We do recognize.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
And then what does that say? Today we had an individual submission, and those submissions were just all with fun dates that they had in the first of all, the research is put down as detailed. We obviously don't take the school, we work you as emergency cases. And then we will inform our service providers about that. And we expect the commitment to receive the support as soon as possible. So we know that the appropriate service was there. Then it comes to submissions by group or organizers. We are going to look at some issues that are that are national prevalent. And then, like we said earlier on, we're going to research the Victims' Department. And we're going to ask them what comes. And all of this will be done before we go into the city. We take it from 12, the 12th December. So that will be done. And then what I'd like to say to the members, because I think Parliament is so on, was I remember last week we spoke at 5 o'clock, that we all need to go back to Parliament. Is there anything that you'd like to say to us? And then I'd like to thank everyone
Okay. Yeah, thanks for your assistance.
Yeah, I'll be back tomorrow.
Okay.
recording.
Yeah.
Did you copy your recording onto your laptop, your brother?
No,
just
USB
MP3.
Yeah. Here's the tag and the player, and then you have to take the two presentations offline. And mark this one number two, the opportunity to mark the first one number one.
Which one number?
The recording.
The recording.
Yeah, the recording is number one.